Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Malcolm Burnley, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, police in Philadelphia will soon be barred from stopping drivers for minor traffic violations, like an expired inspection sticker or a single broken brake light. We'll talk to the author of the groundbreaking legislation, City Councilman Isaiah Thomas, and later, what to make of the surprising prevalence of COVID-19 in white-tailed deer. We talk to two infectious disease experts from Penn State University. But to begin, geothermal energy is not a household name yet, like nuclear or solar, but it's a green technology that is picking up steam in the region as a possible alternative to fossil fuels. Geothermal energy relies on underground pumps drawing natural heat from deeper in the earth to both warm and cool buildings. It's a form of renewable energy that might save cost and reduce climate-harming methane gas, furthering Mayor Kenney's goal of Philadelphia becoming carbon neutral by 2050. A recent 81-page report cited geothermal as one of three key areas for the city to consider in reducing its carbon footprint, but Philadelphia Gas Works, the public utility, appears to be lukewarm on a pivot to geothermal. To break it all down, we have Susan Phillips, energy, environment, and climate change reporter for WHYY News. Susan, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So in one of your recent stories, one of the experts you quoted called geothermal energy caveman technology. And that wasn't to say that it was simple, but because it shares some properties with caves. Can you explain that basic concept?
Sure. I mean, it is actually kind of simple. And just to back up a little bit, geothermal, it refers to a lot of different things. And so I don't want to confuse people. A lot of us, what might think of Iceland, which is tapping into really, you know, hot thermal springs or volcanic energy. But what we're talking about here is what some people call network geothermal, other people call geogrid. They're sort of trying to come up with a name for it that would distinguish it from other more larger geothermal projects. So what it is, you're drilling down into the bedrock, right? You're not going very deep. You're going 200, 300, 400 feet deep. And it's not, you know, it's just wide enough. It's like drilling a well. It's just wide enough to put in piping, you know, about 3 or 4 inches down. And then, you know, when you hit the bedrock, that temperature, which in this area is granite, is always going to be around 52, 54, 55 degrees. So when you talk about what one of the sources said, caveman technology, think of it like this. Think of it like when you walk into a cave on a summer day, it's cooler in the cave. When you walk into it on a winter day, it's warmer. It's always the same temperature when you go deep into the cave because it's sort of deep underground. So it's not reliant, and it doesn't fluctuate based on the ambient air temperature above ground. So what it's doing is using that, you know, consistent temperature to then power a, you know, or it's connected to a heat pump, and a heat pump is what many people already know, because a heat pump is what's used, say, for instance, in your refrigerator or in an air conditioner. It basically shifts the warm air to a different place. So if it's your refrigerator, it takes the warm air out of your refrigerator and puts it in your kitchen. So what this is doing is just simply, you know, taking advantage of this consistent temperature underground, using the water to, you know, it's not, yeah, right. So the water comes up and helps, like, you know, and then the heat pump doesn't have to work too hard to either cool or heat a building.
Right. So the basic concept is that there's kind of a climate or a reservoir, I think is the term that often comes up, holding this air or this, you know, heat that can be pumped in or cooled, as you said, into the building. What are some of the basic, I guess, environmental consequences, or I should say, I guess, environmental benefits of geothermal compared to natural gas or compared to, I guess, conventional electric heat?
So what a lot of people are saying right now, in order to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, is we have to electrify, right? And that means in the case of heating and cooling, not using natural gas or not using natural gas to cook, right? So what, you know, what a heat pump does is it uses the electric, it does have to use some of the electricity from the grid, but not as much because this temperature is the same temperature. The water that's coming up from deep below the ground is the same temperature. So you're not putting as much greenhouse gas emissions into the air because you're not burning fossil fuels to heat or cool your house.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. So this sounds like somewhat of a maybe foreign concept to a lot of people, I think, even though the technology, as you said, is relatively simple. You actually found that there's a number of instances of geothermal energy already being used in the region. Where are some of those examples?
Sure. So this is not necessarily a new technology. It's been around for decades, and there's definitely a lot of buildings that use it. It's really easy when it's new construction because all you have to do is just dig the holes beneath the basement level of the building you're building. So it's been used. It's used at Stockton State College. It's used at the Friends Center in Center City. It's used a lot of people's houses around the region. It's used at the police academy, and it's also used in my story. I focused on the Pennsylvania German society in Spring Garden, where that is sort of it's a pretty old building. It was built in the 1800s, but they were able to retrofit it in order to use geothermal. And what they were able to do is use their parking lot for the wells. So that's kind of important. If you're going to retrofit something, you're going to have to need some space to drill down, to lay these pipes underneath the ground.
Right. And so just using that example, roughly how much might a system for a building of that size cost? Say, you know, a multi-story, but not a massive apartment building.
Yeah. So this is where it gets tricky. It's really dependent upon the situation, right? In the case of that building, they had so many different heating systems. They had like every heating system you can imagine, including like, you know, fireplaces and window air conditioners. And they wanted to sort of get rid of all of it and have one system that wouldn't impact the environment and wouldn't put more carbon emissions into the air. And so to drill the wells is probably the most expensive part of the issue because you have to, you know, get a drill rig in there and drill these wells. But for the German Society, I think theirs cost $1.4 million. There's about 20,000 square feet in the building. But again, it was like they thought it was the best option because they were going to have to redo everything anyway. They have a lot of rare books and a library in there that they needed to preserve. So it's just that's one of the things that the cost of this is one of the things that is sort of up in the air. I mean, there's a pilot project happening up in Massachusetts where there's a couple utilities, Eversource and another utility, that are actually doing pilot projects in a neighborhood. So what they're going to do is sort of drill down in the middle of the street and lay the pipes just like where deeper than, you know, they're going to have to drill deeper than where your gas and water pipes are in the street. But there's still, you know, sort of parallel to the current gas pipes that are in the street right now, and then hook up about 100 different homes to this system. And yeah, so it's you know, and they're still trying to figure out like what the costs are going to be and what the business model is going to be. But essentially what they'll probably do, what they're doing in the beginning, is going to be charging a fee. But it's certainly not going to cost, you know, you're not going to get a gas bill. Those folks are not going to be getting a gas bill anymore. Right. But they'll get some kind of bill that reflects the delivery of that heating and cooling.
So, Susan, in the interest of time, I want to get to Philadelphia Gas Works, because we know Mayor Kenney recently announced the goal of making Philadelphia carbon neutral by 2050 to come in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. And to get there, a lot of people are calling for Philadelphia Gas Works, which we know is the largest municipally owned gas utility in the country, to switch to more renewable energies. This is not a new call, of course, but geothermal has been getting a lot of attention of late. Could you talk about City Council recently hosted the new new CEO of Philadelphia Gas Works, Seth Shapiro. He actually talked about geothermal. What did you get from what he said in testifying?
Yeah, so it's unfortunate because Seth Shapiro, PGW, hasn't, you know, talked to us, talked to WHYY about any of stories we've done about them recently. So we haven't had been able to have like a real conversation with him, even for the geothermal story. But, you know, basically, they have said that they are willing to do a pilot project or a feasibility study about geothermal in Philadelphia.
So it sounds like relatively non-committal, to say the least. I mean, does it sound like there has any plans to do any type of piloting or, you know, project-based work on a smaller scale around geothermal with PGW or not for now?
Well, like I said, they've committed to it. But listen, I mean, it's kind of a tricky thing for PGW. I mean, they're sort of like, you know, this utility that's been around since 1836, and they deliver gas, natural gas. And WHYY has definitely done some reporting around how, you know, they have resisted, you know, they have supported legislation in Harrisburg that would have tied, you know, could tie the city's hands in terms of climate change. So it's something that what the utility has to figure out is, you know, this is their business model, and it's been their business model for over 100 years. It's a tough thing, you know, for anyone to try to switch that business model. And they've got, you know, a large number of ratepayers who have difficulty paying their bills right now as it is.
Right.
So they don't want to create a situation that would be cost prohibitive, that would increase the rates and the gas bills. They also want to maintain their workforce because they have a unionized workforce that, you know, they're good paying jobs. It's a workforce that they, you know, are loyal to and don't, you know, and want to maintain. So any situation, you know, and this is what the diversification study is looking at, any situation of transforming PGW has to take all those things into account, has to think about, you know, not just the cost to the ratepayers, not just, you know, maintaining union jobs, but also how do you decarbonize this more than century old fossil fuel utility? But there were things that Seth Shapiro said in that hearing that seemed to indicate that he thinks that natural gas is going to be around forever. And he talked about how, you know, electrifying heating and cooling doesn't reduce carbon emissions. And that doesn't hold up. I mean, that's even in the diversification plan, it talked about how electrification of heating and cooling will reduce carbon emissions. And even, you know, and they got that information from PJM, which is our regional grid operator. And the regional grid operator says it, you know, electrification does, you know, reduce carbon emissions. So there just seems to be a fundamental disconnect between what the city's goals are and some of the things that you hear coming from PGW executives.
We'll definitely be following this story and have to talk about rate increases and the potential of geothermal. So, Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Up next, we have Council Member Isaiah Thomas on the Driving Equality Bill. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the regional roundup from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Malcolm Burnley. After a long road, Philadelphia passed driving equality bills last October. The new legislation, which takes effect on the 24th of this month, means that police will no longer stop drivers for 8 minor traffic violations, including minor bumper issues or a single broken brake light. A companion bill also requires the PPD to keep more meticulous records of its traffic stops going forward. Those changes come on the heels of data produced by the Defender Association of Philadelphia, which analyzed more than 300,000 vehicle stops in the city. That data showed that black drivers accounted for 72% of all vehicular stops compared to just 15% of white drivers. That disparity existed despite the arrest rate for both groups being nearly identical, meaning police were no more likely to find a gun, contraband, or evidence of a crime despite stopping black drivers at much, much higher rates. We have the author of those bills on the line, City Council Member Isaiah Thomas. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Excited to have the conversation, and I appreciate your description of the legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for being here. So this legislation was a long time coming. You first introduced it way back, or the first introduced a version of it, I should say, way back in October 2020. Now that it's passed, what does this mean for Philadelphians?
So for us, what we feel like we're doing is moving our city forward and taking positive steps in the right direction as it relates to improving relationships between communities of color and law enforcement, as well as becoming much more efficient as city government. We know that we have a number of issues in our municipality, and the biggest goal with this legislation is to put us in a position to be able to allow law enforcement, police officers, to be able to focus on some of the bigger issues that we see, again, while simultaneously improving those relationships between police and community of color. Communities of color.
Yeah, and so you've probably gotten a lot of questions about this, but just to clear up any confusion around this, some of the minor violations that are essentially being decriminalized include a loud muffler, failure to signal, one broken taillight, but not two. Is that the full list? What else do people have to know, I guess? Please go ahead.
So noise ordinances are actually not a part of the legislation. So if you do have a modified muffler or some other type of noise ordinance as it relates to your motor vehicle, you can still be pulled over and there be a citation given for whatever the motor vehicle code violation is, as well as not failing to use a turn signal. Mm-hmm. The seven motor vehicle code violations that are now have been moved to secondary means of enforcement, which means you still can get a ticket. It just wouldn't be the primary cause of a traffic stop, are something that impairs the vision. Commonly, we see a car freshener or air freshener as an example of that. Emission and inspection stickers, which are the two stickers on the front windshield, minor damage to the bumper, one taillight being out, and a 60-day grace period on registration. So those are the things that are now secondary means of enforcement as it relates to motor vehicle code violations. But anything else that's a public safety hazard, speeding, running a stop sign, not using a turn signal, or most importantly, if the police have probable cause, someone can still be pulled over.
Right. And I want to invite our listeners, if they do have comments for the councilman or just want to join the conversation, email us at radiotimes@whiy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or call in 1-888-477-9499. So out of the ones that were reclassified, the minor traffic violations, as you just said, were these ones that tended to affect Black drivers more, or were these simply, I guess, the ones that were safest to reclassify for public safety? You know, these were the ones that wouldn't inhibit public safety.
Most of them are things that wouldn't inhibit public safety. I think the one that Black drivers are classified more is the expired registration one, but everything else are things that we felt like were things that would not have a negative impact on public safety, and things that we felt like we can use as it relates to modifying the means of enforcement for those particular type of motor vehicle code violations. So it's really a combination of both.
Got it. So we know that traffic stops also have led or have contributed to some of the high-profile tragedies involving Black Americans and law enforcement in recent years. Just a couple examples, Philando Castile, we know, who was Black and killed during a traffic stop on July 2016. He had been pulled over dozens of times by police. And then Sandra Bland, another example, who's, although her death was while in police custody, which was eventually ruled a suicide controversially, was originally stopped in Texas for failing to signal a lane change. Did any of those incidents or that, I guess, the general gravitas of that moment also influence your thinking around this bill?
I think the biggest influence for me is actually my personal lived experiences as well as the experiences of other constituents across the city of Philadelphia. For a lot of us growing up in the city, it's just basically a rite of passage to be pulled over by law enforcement on a consistent basis. It's why a lot of mentors, coaches, fathers, uncles, cousins are forced to be in a position to have the quote-unquote talk with other young men of color, because it's inevitable that if you drive long enough in this city, you'll eventually be pulled over. And unfortunately, everybody doesn't go through that. And so we're fortunate or unfortunate. Either way, it's a prejudice that exists, and it's not fair that one demographic goes through a specific negative experience that other people are not forced to essentially go through. So the foundation starts there. When I do think about what happened to the different national issues and national situations where we've seen unarmed folks gunned down by law enforcement, I do think about some of those situations, especially when you're talking about Philando, who was killed in front of his family, right? I think that's the one thing that folks don't talk about is, you know, how much of a threat can a person be with their child in the back seat and their wife in the driver's seat? That's just not something that you're going to commonly see, is the person is not a person of color. So does it touch me emotionally? Absolutely. But the foundation of the legislation is rooted in lived experiences of Philadelphia.
Yeah, so other cities and municipalities in the country have tried to amend some of these traffic violations, but my understanding is that Philadelphia now is the first city in the country to really codify this in legislation. Could you speak just about, I guess, the importance of making sure that this is in legislation as opposed to, I guess, a policy that's not codified?
I mean, for us, we wanted this to be something that we legislate because we recognize the importance of having sustainable and systematic solutions. When you're talking about problems and ills that have had a significant impact on people of color, when you're talking about issues and examples of systematic racism, we have to legislate our way out of those situations. And for us, it's not enough just to have a policy that could be modified based on who the leadership is in the city of Philadelphia. We wanted something that can be entrenched in the DNA of our city. And we want to recognize the fact that right now what's entrenched in the DNA of our city is for young men of color to be consistently pulled over. We want to deviate away from that. We want to put ourselves in a position where the narrative and the lived experiences are different if you're born and raised in the city of Philadelphia. And we want to improve the relationships between communities of color and law enforcement. Unfortunately, far too many people, their first introduction to a police officer is a traffic stop, and we want that to be a different. We want that to be different. We want a different set of lived experiences.
So PPD Commissioner Daniel Outlaw came out in support of this bill eventually, but the police department has resisted, you know, similar reforms in the past. What changed?
Well, I've been in city council since 2020, so I'm not quite sure how things worked prior to me getting there as it relates to internal politics, because I wasn't privy to those conversations or experiences, but I know for us, we started with our colleagues in city council, and once we feel like we had enough votes to be able to put ourselves in a position where the legislation was veto-proof, we reached out to the mayor, we reached out to the managing director's office, we reached out to the police commissioner, and we just asked for a collaborative effort, and nobody at any time was opposed to having a collaborative effort. We might not all agree on solutions and mechanisms as it relates to what enforcement could look like. But that is the point of coming together, so that everybody can share their vision and what they recommend and what they go through on a consistent basis as police officers, as elected officials, as people of color, and come up with something that we feel like can be a happy compromise for everybody. And I think when you talk about this legislation, of course, the concept in the bill itself is historic, but I think the collaboration, the collaborative effort, the coalition that we were able to create is just as historic.
So we have a tweet from Bill that gets into some pushback. Bill says, "No wonder homicides and crime in general are on the rise with Philadelphia passing laws like this. The mayor and city council refuse to address crime, substandard public schools, taxes and jobs, leaving Philadelphia." Now, that's probably a common sentiment that you've heard about some of the pushback on the bill, and I can get into others. You know, another one was David Fisher, a retired Philly cop, in a reporting by WHYY, talked about possibly the impact this would have on people not getting car insurance, right? People being uninsured.
The car insurance. Yeah, the car insurance claim is false. So we don't even want to do a deep dive into anything that is inaccurate information, because we know that in other parts of the country, especially in communities that are not communities of color, it's pretty common for people to use things like technology and other means and mechanisms to enforce motor vehicle code violations that are a public safety hazard, like speeding. So if you don't see an increase in insurance for places who use different means of enforcement for things that are a public safety hazard, you wouldn't see an increase in insurance here for that. As it relates to the crime, on a consistent basis, we're doing what we feel like we can as legislators to address the crime in the city of Philadelphia, because, again, that's our job. We create laws and pass budgets. And I think sometimes what happens is when people think about city council, who's the low-hanging fruit, they don't necessarily understand exactly what our job is. So when we pass bills like this, we're first and foremost acknowledging the trauma and the civil rights violations that has existed in the past. But more importantly, we're trying to put ourselves in a position to improve the relationship between communities of color and law enforcement. I would challenge Bill or anybody else who looks at the legislation to put yourself in a position to be able to say, would you want to be pulled over for having a car freshener hanging from your car? Would you want to be pulled over for having one taillight out, which you probably didn't know was out? These are things that nobody wants to be pulled over for, but everybody thinks it's necessarily when it's not happening to them. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the people who's getting pulled over on a consistent basis, the people who see this as a rite of passage, the college student who has to travel up and down 95, 76, or 611 just to be able to try to put themselves in a position to better themselves, to know that every time a police car gets behind them, their stomach drops, they get nervous. They're in a position where they feel like they're weak and vulnerable and they can't do anything about it. Most of the people who criticize the legislation, they don't know that feeling. They don't go through that on a consistent basis, and they don't understand or respect other people's lived experiences when they're telling them this is a consistent problem. They also don't look at the data, because the data suggests that not only do we spend anywhere from $10 to $30 million a year as a city on lawsuits, which often start with a traffic stop, the data also tells us, because we've been pulling people over for at least my entire adult life, that traffic stops don't stop crime. And if traffic stops did stop crime, we probably wouldn't have seen the record number of homicides that we've seen over the last 2 years. So I'm always welcoming any type of debate or dialogue around the driving equality legislation. I just want the conversation to be grounded in facts. If people are legitimately concerned about the legislation because they think it'll have a negative impact on public safety, we want you to provide factual information that communicates that. Where we stand right now, based on our conversation with law enforcement, as well as a number of different partners who was a part of our coalition, we do not believe that this will have a negative impact on crime at all. If anything, we feel like it could put us in a position where we can have a positive impact on a crime in the city.
We're having a conversation with Council Member Isaiah Thomas. If you want to join the conversation, email us at radiotimes@whry.org, tweet us at WHRY Radio Times, or call in 1-888-477-9499. I'm Malcolm Burnley. This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup at WHRY in Philadelphia. Before I did misstate, and I'm happy you corrected me about which violations had been reclassified. Along those lines, too, isn't it true that police can still send a warning or a citation without pulling someone over? That still gives them the power to do that if, you know, they are violating safety on the roads.
Police can mail a ticket, but you can also get a ticket on your windshield as well, too. So B patrol officers walking past your car and your emission stickers is expired or your registration stickers are expired, you can still get ticketed for that, not just by a police officer, but we also have Philadelphia Parking Authority officers in the city of Philadelphia as well, too, that are responsible for enforcing some of these minor traffic violations. So by no means are we moving away from a mechanism of lacking on enforcement. Actually, one of our concerns, which we're going to monitor as we look at the data and use technology, is to assure that we do not have a disproportionate amount of enforcement in poor communities and communities of color. We actually anticipate an increase of enforcement as it relates to some of these minor motor vehicle code violations over the next couple of years, because we'll be moving towards technology as a means of enforcement. And if you look at what's happening on some of our state highways that now have the speeding cameras, you see a significant level of increase as it relates to enforcement. We see the same thing happening with other minor motor vehicle code violations. So for folks that we don't want to give people the perception that we're putting ourselves in a position where Philadelphia is going to lack on the enforcement. What we are going to do is minimize some of the contact that happens between police and communities of color when we're talking about traffic violations. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to minimize enforcement.
Right. And I remember when, you know, the city, I know it's ongoing, was reforming stop and frisk practices. I remember hearing from a lot of police officers that acknowledged, no, I don't necessarily want to be forced is a strong word, but to stop people on the street for, you know, minor things. You hosted a series of working groups that you already referred to between the PPD, the Defenders Association, other stakeholders. Did you hear any similar sentiment from police officers that, you know, this is actually going to be good for their job?
We do believe that this is going to be good for their job. We think that some of the folks that we work with as it relates to the leadership in the police department feels like they can have that type of positive effect as well, too. Based on how we're doing as it relates to conversation, brainstorming, and implementation, we're not having much dialogue with the rank and file, just because that's not necessarily the position that we're obligated to commit to as legislators. We are focused on what we have to do as it relates to our component of this bill, and we're we're optimistic that the administration, as well as the police commissioner, are having those conversations and doing their due diligence to make sure that the accurate information is trickling down to the rank and file, and folks hopefully understand that this is something that could be a positive for all parties. Hmm.
Since October, or more recently, have you heard from lawmakers elsewhere in the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've heard from people all across the country. I'm actually going to Pittsburgh on Wednesday to testify on driving equality and talk to some of the legislators out there about how we were able to pass the legislation and put it in a position where it'll be implemented later this month. We've talked to people in Illinois. We've talked to people on the West Coast, people in the South, people up north in New York. It's been an amazing opportunity to share legislative ideas with colleagues and like-minded people all across the country. That part has been pretty amazing, but I think the other side of it is people trying to figure out exactly how they mold and modify the legislation to fit their demographic. And so that part is where we try to explain to people that the most important thing about our legislation is the fact that it was a collaborative effort. It's not us telling the police what they're going to do. It's us sitting together and working with the police to figure out what we are going to do as a city. And that's the component of this process that a lot of times other legislators from across the country don't necessarily recognize the importance of that component.
Mm. So we only have about 30 seconds left. I just wanted to ask you about the data component. You know, there's the companion bill. A big impetus for passing this was the Defenders Association data that I cited, right? They had to do their own data. How is the bill, thus the companion bill, requiring the PPD to report traffic stops with more meticulous data? How is that going to help the situation going forward in about 20 seconds?
I mean, that's extremely important because it puts us in a position to monitor the process. And if the data tells us anything as it relates to something that might have an impact on public safety, as well as a new traffic stop that are just disproportionately impacting people of color, we now know what's going on. We also know if there are law enforcement officers who are not necessarily following the law. Mm. So we love the data component, and the transparency is going to help us moving forward.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Councilmember Isaiah Thomas, author of the Driving Equality Bills. When we come back, we're talking pandemic in the wild. This is Malcolm Burnley, in for Mary Cummings Jordan, the Regional Roundup. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is a regional roundup from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Malcolm Burnley. Herd immunity among humans is still a hotly debated topic when it comes to COVID-19, but what about herd immunity when it comes to animals? Earlier in the pandemic, news that household cats and dogs had tested positive for the virus raised fears in every pet owner. Now, researchers are making new discoveries about wild animals and the shockingly high prevalence of variants like Omicron out in nature. Here to talk to us about it is Vivek Kapoor, is the Hook Distinguished Chair in Global Health and Professor of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at Penn State University, and Suresh Kuchipudi is also a professor and chair of Emerging Infectious Diseases and Associate Director of the Animal Diagnostic Lab at Penn State University. Thank you both for being here.
Well, thanks for having us on.
So I wanted to start.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Absolutely. So I wanted to start with just a few terms, maybe to set the stage for the conversation. Two terms when I think and read a lot about animal to human contraction is spillover and spillback. Vivek, could you start us off by defining those two terms, spillover and spillback?
Sure. Thanks, Malcolm. Spillovers are infections typically that move from one host to another. In this particular instance, we would expect the spillover to have occurred from bats to humans for the original SARS-CoV-2 virus or a SARS-CoV-2 virus ancestor. The infections that we're talking about, spillovers, in this particular case, are spillovers that are occurring from humans into white-tailed deer that we've seen happen in quite a striking manner and abundance across the country. Spillbacks, on the other hand, would be when something has spilled over and then has a chance to evolve and come back or perhaps not even evolve, but spill back into the host that donated it. So, for instance, a spillover would be when a human gave a virus to a deer, and a spillback would be when the deer gave the same virus back, with or without mutations, back into humans.
So, Suresh, do we have any evidence as of now, in your research or from what you've read, that there's been spill back between deer and humans?
So, Malcolm, that's a great question. So far, based on our research and what we know, there is no evidence of any instance of human infections from the deer. So we do not have that evidence yet.
So when you began looking at the deer lymph nodes, is my understanding, out of deer, white-tailed deer from Iowa that you began analyzing for COVID-19, I'm wondering, Suresh, first, can you say, what did you expect to find when you started looking into this?
Yeah, so when we started this investigation, we are not quite sure how many animals would be positive because, we do not have a clear idea of the extent of infection of white-tailed deer in the wild with the SARS-CoV-2. And also, the chances of detecting virus in an infected animal is a very narrow window of detection, perhaps 3 to 5 days. So going into this research, we weren't expecting to see a lot of positive animals, and we were even thinking, do we even find one animal that may test positive for the virus? But when we started exploring the tissues that we had, and what we found was quite stunning because we found a lot of animals that had the viral nucleic acid in them.
So you were saying
I must say animal tissues.
Yeah. So you were expecting maybe to only find one. And then what was the rate, I guess, of infection that you did end up finding?
So the project we had access to over 5,000 tissue samples from deer collected between April of 2020 through January 2021. And the first study that we published has around 300 tissue samples. And overall, for the entire study period, around 33% of the samples were positive. But the important aspect is that if we focus on the months of November, December of 2020, which coincides with the peak hunting season, but also the time when the infection rate among humans in Iowa is very high, the percent positivity of the tissues was over 80%. And that was incredible to us. We weren't expecting to see anything at that level.
80%. So Vivek, did that correlate with the spikes or the rise in COVID cases among humans in the area around that time?
Yes, Malcolm. As Suresh just mentioned, it coincided really well with the spikes in human infections in Iowa at that particular time. There was a lag of approximately 3 weeks. So the human peak infection was before when at least the tissue positivity in deer peaked.
And Vivek, so Suresh was explaining, you know, this happened during hunting season, or at least if I had the timeline right, a lot of the samples were overlapped with hunting season. Do we have any idea how the deer were contracting COVID in the first place?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and one that we wonder about a lot as well. It's also not clear if there's just simply one means of spillover into deer. So in all likelihood, in fact, there are perhaps multiple routes. The most likely routes are indirect contact. So, for instance, human activity or human tissue that a deer might come in contact with. I think an example we've used quite a bit is a half-eaten apple thrown or left behind the deer comes in contact with, or otherwise a tissue from somebody who's hiking in the woods a deer comes in contact with, and might pick it up. Once an animal, a deer in particular, is infected, because they're so highly susceptible, they're able to transmit it amongst the deer fairly quickly. And so it's not simply the original spillover, but it's also subsequently the rapid between deer transmission that occurs that causes these high rates of tissue positivity.
That's really interesting because I keep thinking about social distancing, right? And in humans staying, you know, 6 feet, roughly 6 feet away from each other. And while deer obviously don't participate with social distancing rules, you know, generally speaking, they're pretty resistant to be around people. But so you're saying that possibly one theory, I guess, is that they could have picked it up through food waste or some other something else that was contaminated from a human.
Yes, certainly. And other means, absolutely. And other means of transmission could have been an intermediary host. So, for instance, feral cats, mice, even bats that might be infected. We just don't know. Alternatively, it could be also food sources. So individuals actually do a lot of feeding of deer, particularly in peri-domestic settings. And there's opportunities in, at least in rural and suburban areas where there's quite an abundance of deer. My yard, for example, just got tons of deer, where humans might be able to contact deer indirectly.
Suresh, I read that the American Rescue Plan Act actually allocated roughly $6 million specifically towards researching coronavirus in white-tailed deer. Why is this important, I guess, to be tracking increasingly? And is there a concern that potentially humans could be contracting some type of new variant that spreads in the wild?
Yeah, Malcolm, that's a very, very important question. So there are two major aspects about coronavirus in the deer. In the short term, the risk of human contracting the infection is more likely with another human being. So the source of infection for a person is likely another person and less likely the deer. But in the long term, what is critical is that when the virus spills over into an abundant animal species, in this case deer in North America, and as we saw from our recent study, we also found the most recent variant Omicron spillover into deer in New York. So what it is suggesting us is that this must be, or this probably is, an ongoing process. And as the virus continues to spill over and perhaps circulate in these animal species, and viruses are likely to evolve, and that's what we saw in human beings. So since the start of the pandemic, as the virus circulated in humans, we saw periodically the novel variants emerged. And same thing is also likely to happen in any other animal host when the virus continues to circulate. So the major concern is that if we let this happen unmonitored, and such unmonitored transmission of the virus in the deer could result in emergence of novel variants that may potentially escape the protection of the vaccines. And therefore, monitoring deer and to understand the evolution of the virus and the potential risks to animal health as well as human health are very, very important.
Vivek, do we know if deer are more susceptible to COVID or other viruses compared to, say, dogs or cats? Do, you know, pet owners have to worry as much about their animals contracting this as white-tailed deer?
Yes, a great question. So we do know deer are very susceptible. We do also, based on epidemiologic information, just our own, as well as experimental studies, know that cats can be quite susceptible as well. Dogs are less so, but deer apparently are much more susceptible than many other animal species described thus far.
And do you know, does that apply to COVID in particular? Or, I mean, have you studied other, infectious diseases that are also the case with deer?
Deer tend to be susceptible to several infections that humans get quite a bit as well. A lot of the coronaviruses that circulate, for instance, in cattle tend to spill over into deer. Ruminants share a lot of these. In terms of other infections, bacterial infections are quite often found in deer. Chronic wasting disease is what is surveilled for quite a bit in deer, as well as tuberculosis. Those are the things that, at least in the U.S., there are quite a few surveillance programs for. There are other viral diseases as well, but many of them tend not to be zoonotic, other than tuberculosis and chronic wasting disease.
How should people respond, I guess, to this information? And I say that because in Denmark during the pandemic, authorities wound up slaughtering, I believe the number was 17 million mink, because they were afraid that COVID was spreading amongst them and potentially could have some of those spillover effects or spillback effects that we were talking about. I wanted to get, Suresh, your reaction, I guess, to authorities doing that. Was that an overreaction? And then also, I mean, more largely, what do we do with the knowledge that you're giving us?
Yeah, that's a great question, Malcolm. So first, I just wanted to clarify the terms of COVID and SARS coronavirus 2 infection. So what we know so far is the infection of these animals, be it cats, dogs, or deer, with the virus, which is SARS coronavirus 2. But the COVID is a specific term we use to describe the disease caused by the virus in humans. So far, we do not have strong evidence of the animals actually getting the disease. So we should call it a SARS-CoV-2 infection.
Thank you for that.
And with regards to what can be done, I think the decision in any given country, a particular animal, is probably based on several aspects, including the disease risk is one of them. Perhaps there are other aspects. But if we think about this, there are other zoonotic viruses that also circulate in animals, and there are reservoirs. So I can give an example, which is rabies, and we have programs that monitor rabies in wild animals. And similarly, influenza is also a virus which is zoonotic and circulates in lots of animal species. So this information is really important for us to understand the ecology and the evolution of the virus. And it doesn't mean that when we find a virus circulating in an animal, the solution is to cull all those animals. And that's probably not the option in many, many instances, and especially if it is a wild animal species. But this information is important and helps us to understand how the virus is spreading to these animals in the first place, or what is the risk of onward transmission of the virus from infected animals to other animals of the same species or other species. And once we understand these risks of transmission and transmission networks, it helps us to better define the risk and then see what the critical mm-hmm. control points are. And therefore, we can implement more strategic and targeted interventions.
And I'll just remind our listeners, I'm Malcolm Burnley, and you're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Thank you for that, Suresh. And Vivek and Suresh, we have only about a minute left. This is such a fascinating conversation. Are you looking at any other animals currently, or are you going to be focusing, I guess, your ongoing research around white-tailed deer?
Suresh, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, sure. So, Malcolm, we at Penn State, we have this interest on looking at COVID in animals, and we have been working on several other animal species also. And currently, the major focus is on deer because of the importance, but we are also looking at other companion animals and domestic animals, including livestock, to answer some of the questions pertaining to how are the most recent variants perhaps are capable of infecting livestock, and then see what are the implications. So we will continue to work on deer, but also on the other animals as it relates to COVID in animals.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there, but it was a fascinating conversation, and thank you both. Vivek Kapoor is the Huck Distinguished Chair in Global Health and Professor of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at Penn State University, and Suresh Kuchipudi, Professor and Chair of Emerging Infectious Diseases and Associate Director of the Animal Diagnostic Lab, also at Penn State University. The Regional Roundup, I'm Malcolm Burnley, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Radio Times is produced by Paige Murray Bestler and Debbie Builder. And we'll see. Marty will be back tomorrow. Thank you for listening.